Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 118, I show you around my new studio and answer questions from the chat room. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 2nd, 2012, episode 118, in the new studio. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This is my first week at my new time, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, in my new studio, which is actually my home recording studio, which I've had for many, many years. And I decided to move back here because the bandwidth issues in the old studio where I was, which was in my corporate office, they shaped the bandwidth and prioritized traffic to the point where my outgoing video was, shall we say, less than ideal. So I came back home with nice, clean bandwidth from Charter Communications, my cable modem, a cable provider here, and I believe it's going to be much better. I'm in standard def at the moment, for those of you who are watching the video. At some point, I will switch to high def, but I decided that standard def was better. If it was smoother than high def, that was really jerky and choppy. I'm going to give you a quick tour of the studio in a moment, those of you who are watching the video. Those of you who are just listening, please excuse me when we get to that. It'll just take a couple minutes and I'll describe everything that I'm showing people. But I really wanted to give everybody a sense of the new space that I will be in from now for a while. I also want to point out that I've got some new equipment. Up till now, I was using a Blue Yeti USB microphone, which worked just fine. But I have since upgraded to a Heil PR40, the same microphone used by many of TWiT's hosts and throughout the TWiT Brickhouse studio. And I want to thank Bob Heil very much. He's a very good friend of TWiT and a host of the Ham Nation podcast, which is now on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central, or 9 p.m. Eastern. So be sure to tune in for that and all that wonderful ham geekiness. In addition to the Heil PR40, which is right here, I'm using a new thing from Bob, which is the USBQ. Let me pull that up so you can take a look at that. This is a little purple stick, which is a USB mic preamp and EQ, two-band EQ with a high setting and a low setting, and it connects a XLR mic cable, which is the professional type of microphone cable, and converts to USB, so I can put that right into the computer. And the folks in the chat room are saying that that it sounds great, and I'm really glad to hear that. I will be adjusting the EQ a little bit as we go, so listen to it and hear what it sounds like. And in addition, I'm wearing the new Pro Set 3 headphones from Bob Heil as well. He's been making headphones for years for ham radio operators, but these are his first true audio headphones that are intended for audio listening and so on. So he was kind enough to send those along, and I'm giving them a try, and so far I'm digging them. So let me give you a tour of the studio real quick, and I'm going to change microphones for that so that you can continue to hear what I'm saying. If I can just get this microphone out from under the little thing there. I'm going to switch in my preferences here to the Plantronics headset. Hang on just a moment, please. Okay, here we are. It probably sounds very different. This will allow me to step behind the camera and give you a quick tour of my home recording studio, which is now my podcast studio. So here we go. As you can see, as I switch my own monitor around, I'm facing the control center of my home recording studio. I'm going to point the camera down a little bit. You can see that I have a Soundcraft Spirit Studio mixer, an analog mixer. This studio used to be analog altogether in years gone by. Now, of course, I will be recording everything digitally, but this mixer sounds so good that I'm going to hang on to it. You also see a pair of Tannoy NFM8 studio monitors. These are concentric driver monitors with a woofer and a tweeter at the center of the woofer. You can see in that little gold section in the center. And up above the speakers there, I have a variety of things just for fun. My Tix clock, of course, couldn't do without that. In the center, you see the Cylon head from the original Battlestar Galactica wearing the Twit fez. So I thought that was kind of cool. And over here, you can see my Twit brick, which says Geek Out. And that, of course, is a replica of the one in the brick house on the wall there. My rainbow clock. Oh, this is kind of interesting. This is a starfish, an actual real starfish, with beadwork done by the Huichol people of Mexico. I got that in Cabo San Lucas, and it's a very beautiful piece. My wife and I collect Huichol art, and that is just one example. My lava lamp, of course. Here is my equipment rack, which includes several synthesizers and some signal processors, a DAT recorder, which is probably not going to be used too much anymore. And as we swing over here, we see the keyboard section. And I have two keyboards, both of which are made by Kurzweil, which I really like the Kurzweil synthesizers very much. The K2000 at the top and the 2500 at the bottom, both of which were used extensively in my wife's last album, which was recorded with this very equipment. Above that is the Yamaha VL1 wind synthesizer, which I use with the wind controller. It's like an electronic clarinet. And I hope to show you more of that at another time. So there is my studio. And I thank you for indulging me and letting me show you around a little bit. Yeah, it's kind of a small rig, Eldrick. But it actually has several synthesizers in it that make multiple sounds, and everything is actually quite good. And of course, now these days, I will be using more and more computer software synthesizers, but these are from 10 or so years ago. Now I'm going to go back to the Heil microphone and put on my Heil headphones. I'm totally Heiled out here. And I think I'm back in the saddle. You didn't see Jade DeBell, did not see an Alesis ADAT. That was actually probably what you were looking at, was the Panasonic DAT, two-channel digital audio tape player, recorder and player. And the Seeker says that the Heil mic sounds sweet. I'm really glad to hear that, because I am digging it totally myself. yes, Stunwin, my room could very easily be slathered with UV posters, Hendrix posters from the 60s. That was, in fact, the time when I was coming of age, and so that would certainly be most appropriate. Web 4416, I can't play the keyboards right now because the music part of the studio isn't quite back together yet. But I am going to tell you that I intend to produce and play music from this room for you in the Twit audience at some point in the future. That is certainly my intention. Steve C. says, I have bad video interlace problems when I move around. Sorry about that. I will definitely do what I can to improve things as we go around, as we come along here. Okay, so My wife was gonna stop by since I'm at home now, and we both work at home most of the time. But she's busy with something, so maybe I will. Maybe she'll drop by a little later. In the meantime, I am going to be answering questions from the chat room for this episode. So I do hope that you have. I'm sure I see that you've lined up a bunch of questions. So let's get right to it. Where do I play my instruments? Not a home theater question, but I'll answer it anyway. I mostly play brass instruments, tuba and trombone, and euphonium, and I play in a variety of bands, in a variety of locations, as well as here at my house, and this is, of course, where I record as well. Okay. Joel H. laughs out loud for the Cylon twit. Mrs. Columbo will be joining us shortly, I think, yes. Web4416 asks, when setting up a speaker system, should they all be at the same height and perpendicular to the floor? Well, that's a very good question. The answer is not generally, and we're talking about a surround system here. When we're talking about a surround system, you want the main front right and left to be at the same height, and you want them to be roughly... so that the tweeters, the high-frequency drivers, are more or less at ear height. And that's because high frequencies are more directional, and so you want them to be roughly at ear height. The center channel, most of the time, will be either below or above the screen and aimed at the listening position. The surround speakers... are generally placed above the seated ear height by a couple of feet. And there are a couple of different kinds of surround speakers. One is known as bipole or dipole, and that just refers to whether or not there are drivers facing forward and backward. And bipole and dipole refers to whether or not the drivers move in phase with each other or out of phase with each other. And that is that we use a bipole or dipole speaker for the surrounds, at least on the sides or slightly behind the listener position, to create an ambience, a generalized sort of sound field back there. You don't necessarily want things to be very directional coming from the surround speakers. On the other hand, it is argued, and reasonably so, that directional speakers can be used for the surrounds, and if you do, you still might want to put them up kind of high, but aim them down at the listening position on the sides and at the back if you have 7.1. So they don't need to be perpendicular to the floor, and they should be more or less pointed at the listening position, except those bipole dipoles, which can be basically causing a very diffuse sound field around the head. let's see. Let me just quickly go back into the chat room a little bit. Somebody asked what microphone do I use to record instruments? Mostly I use an Audio-Technica AT-41, I believe. No, it's got a different number. It's been so long, I can't remember. It's a condenser mic, and Bob Heil would have some argument with that because he believes in dynamic mics, which the PR40 is. And now that I have a PR40, I might very well try it on recording instruments. So that should be very interesting. Experience. Jay Kinsman 21 asks, what sound bar would I recommend? Well, that depends on how much space you have. Probably the best sound bar I've heard is not actually a bar, but rather a base. It's a big cabinet, not very tall, maybe 5 inches tall, but a couple of feet wide and a couple feet deep. Put your TV on top of it, produces a really wonderful sound. It's from a company called Zvox. And it is the 580 sound. They call them a sound bass instead of a sound bar. If you want a real sound bar, the Vizio VHT215 has a separate subwoofer And that one works quite good. And my friend Larry Ullman is currently in the process of reviewing the Yamaha YSP-101, the low-cost model. The Vizio, by the way, is I think it's about $250 or $300. The Zvox is $300 or $400. It's pretty expensive, but it really sounds great. And the Yamaha is more like $200. It doesn't have a subwoofer built in, but Larry reports that it's sounding really good. So those are three suggestions of good soundbars that I can make right now. Let's see. How did I get my start in audio tech? That's a good question. When I was in college, I was actually a physics major, but I specialized in acoustics and electronic music. I was just fascinated by synthesizers. In those days, the old Moog synthesizer. You remember the cover of Switched on Bach with the big giant synthesizer and all the patch cords? I was fascinated by that. And we had an old Moog Model 12 in the computer or electronic music lab at UC Santa Cruz, where I went to school. And so I spent a lot of time there. My first real job in that field was as a product support specialist at Roland Corporation, makers of synthesizers and various and sundry products like that. So after that, I became a journalist in the audio tech world. I was the editor of Music Technology Magazine, Home and Studio Recording, which became Recording Magazine, and finally the technical editor for Electronic Musician for 10 years. So I spent a long time in that field, and that's kind of how I got going there. Mintaka would like to talk a bit about 3D glasses, certainly one of my favorite subjects. Are they all the same? Will glasses from movie theaters always work in another or on a 3D TV at home? Great question. The answer is they aren't all the same. Let's talk about the commercial cinema first. There are basically two types of commonly available 3D glasses in commercial cinemas. One is called Real-D and one is IMAX. So if you go to an IMAX 3D presentation, and they look very much the same. They're both passive. That is, they don't have any electronics in them. They look like sort of sunglasses. But that one will not work in the other. And the reason is they both use polarization. And they have to have a polarization-preserving screen, kind of a silver screen, so that the left eye image and the right eye image, the light of those two images, retains their polarization. In an IMAX theater, the glasses are what's called linearly polarized. So the light into the right eye is horizontally polarized, left eye, and the light into the right eye is vertically polarized. In a Real-D theater, the glasses use what's called circular polarization. So the light beams are actually rotating. Light waves, I should say, are actually rotating. And for the left eye, they rotate one way. And for the right eye, they rotate the opposite way. So you can't take Real-D glasses into an IMAX or IMAX glasses into a Real-D. However, there are two other types you might find in some commercial cinemas before I move on. One is Dolby 3D, which is a different technology altogether. It's not very common. And it uses, interestingly, it takes the three colors from which all the colors of a display are generated, that is red, green, and blue, and it takes those three colors and shifts them slightly. So the red for the left eye is a little bit different than the red for the right eye, same for the green and the blue. And the glasses filter only one of those sets of red, green, and blue into one eye versus the other eye. It works pretty well, but I find when I wear prescription glasses, and I find that there's some internal reflections between my glasses and the Dolby glasses that cause some ghosting around the edges, which is a little annoying. And it's not very common, so you probably won't run across it. If you do, try it out. See what you think. Real-D is the most common, and IMAX, of course, is IMAX. Arclight cinemas, if you're in an area where there's an ArcLight cinema, we have several here in LA, they have chosen to use active glasses. And these are the kind that have LCD lenses. And one side closes while the other side is open. And then the other side closes while the other side is open. And they all alternate back and forth very quickly while the image on the screen alternates in sync. Now, that's the more common way to do it at home. It's what Panasonic uses, Sony and Samsung all use active shutter glasses at home, but they have a problem compared with the passive glasses, and that is they let less light through to your eye. So active glasses 3D looks dimmer than passive glasses 3D. And Vizio, LG, and Toshiba are now using passive glasses at home. And the interesting thing is, the passive glasses that LG, Vizio, and Toshiba use are real D glasses. So you could take those glasses to the commercial cinema and use them in a real D theater, not in an IMAX theater, not in an ArcLight, because they use active, and not in a Dolby 3D theater. Those aren't very common. Real D is the most common type of cinematic 3D, and the glasses that you get with your TV at home can be used in those theaters. So there is a compatibility there. Alternatively, and I wouldn't recommend stealing, but if you happen to walk out with a pair of Real D glasses from the commercial cinema, you can in fact use them at home if you have an LG or a Vizio or a Toshiba 3D TV. So that's the long and short of 3D glasses. Let's see here. Jojo asks, if you don't have, sometimes the chat room jumps around. I'll see if I can find it again. I'm sorry, I can't find it. AZ Listener asks, along the same line, how do you go about doing a ceiling mounted surround speaker configuration? Assuming the speakers are at a 15% angle. Of course. Well, the ceiling-mounted configuration works okay for the surrounds. I certainly wouldn't recommend it for the fronts or the center because you want the sound to come to seem like it's coming from the screen as close as possible. But again, like I said before, the surround sound field is supposed to be diffuse, so it could be coming from above. If you have directional speakers rather than these bipolar dipoles, you can mount them in the ceiling, and some ceiling-mounted speakers have aimable tweeters, so you can aim them down into the listening position, and that's what I would do. I would also, I forgot to mention earlier that, listening to surround music, that is not movie soundtracks, but actual surround sound music, multi-channel music, it's better really to have directional speakers in the surrounds rather than these bipole dipoles. Beatmaster asks, in theory, every source would need a different speaker position. Well, no, I wouldn't say so. I mean, I guess in theory, if you wanted to recreate the sound of an ensemble on stage, I suppose you could put a separate speaker for all of them. More interesting to me is having a bunch of speakers, but allowing that to recreate a three-dimensional sound field. This is the idea behind Dolby Atmos, which I wrote about quite a bit a week before last, because the movie that has just come out, the new Disney Pixar movie called Brave, is the first to be mixed in Dolby Atmos. And what Dolby Atmos is, it puts speakers all around the audience and overhead. And in addition, it treats sound in an object-oriented way. So we used to think, we still do, think of 5.1 or 7.1 and mixers, sound mixers, put the sound into this channel or that channel and they pan it between channels. What Dolby Atmos does is it says, let's instead think about sound-emitting objects like an airplane or an explosion or a dinosaur or something as an object and specify where it goes in space. So it moves from over here, it flies overhead, and it ends up over there. And we're not going to even worry about which channels it needs to be in. The Dolby Atmos system figures that out for us. So that's exactly what Dolby Atmos does. And in Brave, I thought it worked quite well. More effective is the Dolby Atmos trailer that they play before the movie. That really puts sounds all around, and it's really quite remarkable. I thought Brave was very good, too. I saw it. There's only 14 theaters in the United States, 13 in the United States and one in Toronto, that have Dolby Atmos. And on my website is a list of exactly where they are. So if you're interested in experiencing this, I think it's very important. And so go to hometheater.com and look up, search for Dolby Atmos, and you'll see it's A-T-M-O-S, a made-up word that I suppose evokes atmospheric, you know. Anyway, look for a theater near you if you can find one. I do recommend you go hear it. I heard it at the AMC 16 in Burbank, California. And it was great, but the only problem was the volume was too loud. And it kind of obscured the effect. And Brave is not one of these, you know, whiz-bang, shoot-em-up adventure movies. But they really had the volume cranked a little too loud, certainly for my taste, and I think to make the best use of the Dolby Atmos system. I will also say that I know of at least one case, the Arclight in Sherman Oaks, California, where the Atmos theater, they have one Atmos theater in the whole Cineplex, and that particular theater is showing Brave in 2D. It's a 3D movie. It was created in 3D, and I liked the 3D effects very much. But if you want to see it in 3D, you can't hear the Atmos. They're in different theaters. Plus the fact that Arclight, as I said before, uses the active glasses. They're from a company called Xpand, X-P-N-D, X-P-A-N-D. So I don't recommend going to see Brave at Arclight Sherman Oaks. If you're in the LA area, go to the Burbank AMC 16 or the El Capitan on Hollywood Boulevard or Century City. One of the theaters in Century City has Atmos as well. But go to the website, hometheater.com, look up Dolby Atmos, see where the theaters are. Maybe there's one near you. If there is, I do recommend going to see it in 3D in Dolby Atmos. Call the theater ahead of time. Make sure that they're showing both in the same theater. Web 1979, what are the best 5.1 computer speakers? I'm afraid I don't really do much with computer speakers. For that, I would go to our companion website, audiostream.com, where Michael Lavornia is the editor, and he covers all things computer audio. And I'm sure he would have some great recommendations for computer audio speakers. Delta 9, what audio codec is closest in quality to vinyl records? Well, if you listen to Michael Fremer on my podcast a couple weeks ago, he would probably say none of them. Nah, I'm oversimplifying here. I know that he believes that higher sampling rates and higher bit depths get closer to vinyl. So he's definitely an advocate of 96 kilohertz, 24 bits, rather than the CD rate of 44.1 kilohertz and 16 bits. And going beyond 96 kilohertz to 192 kilohertz would be even better. But he will tell you, and many people will tell you, that vinyl simply has a different qualitative quality, if you will, that it is, it's different. It you can't compare it to digital. Exactly. It's a different experience, a different emotional experience, as well as a different aural experience. So I don't think that one can say that, and I have to agree, that vinyl is a different experience than any kind of digital. I myself am very happy with digital. I like its cleanliness. I tend to prefer it, but I think I'm in the minority amongst audiophiles anyway. Let's see. Web4416, have you noticed whether or not the market and appreciation for high-quality loud music is increasing or decreasing? Hard to say. I think the youngsters all like to listen to loud music, and that worries me because they're going to end up with hearing loss, and it's not immediate. It happens only later in life, and so things are going to... it's going to be a problem, especially wearing earbuds and cranking the iPod or whatever to a high volume. It's really going to end up damaging their hearing later in life. And they don't realize it now. And of course, teenagers always think they're invincible, but they're not. So I always recommend, please keep the volume at a reasonable level and you won't. Damage yourself later. Let's see. Beatmaster asks, sadly, many theaters won't allow you to bring your own glasses. Really? I haven't had that experience before. You can, by the way, getting back to that 3D glasses question, you can also buy your own. A company called Marshawn makes Real D style glasses that is circularly polarized. Both regular glasses and clip-ons for those of us who wear prescriptions. Oakley, I believe, also makes 3D glasses of this type, this circular polarization or Real D type of glasses. So that's what I, you know, if you want to spend the money, I've never had a problem taking my Marshawns to the theater. I mean, you know, heck, you go in, you have them in your pocket, they hand you a pair of glasses from the theater, you take them, you don't even use them. Now, I have heard that some theaters are starting to charge extra for glasses. And if you come across a theater that charges you extra and won't let you bring in your own glasses, boy, I would raise holy heck with the management of that theater because that's really unfair. I would not try to... Joel H., what's better for glasses wearers, 3D inside or outside glasses? Definitely outside. I would have your regular prescription glasses where they normally are and 3D glasses on over those. That's why I prefer one reason I prefer passive glasses is that they're so much lighter and often larger, and they can more easily fit over your regular prescription glasses. Active glasses are big and heavy and clunky, and less comfortable really to wear, and they make the picture dimmer. So let's see. Question for those of us in small houses: can you use surround sound in a room where you are not in the center of the room? I have to sit and place my TV in the far right of the room, and also sit with back to the rear wall. Ugh, that's not so great. I'm sorry to hear that. Is 5.1 going to work in such a situation? Yeah, it'll work. The first thing I would do is try not to sit against the back wall, because low frequencies in particular tend to build up against the wall. And so you're going to get a kind of a boomy sound there. If there's any way at all to move the couch or the chair out into the room at all, that's really going to help the sound a lot. And then also putting your surround speakers either on the sides or on the back wall should work just fine. But that is a problem with small. That's true, with small rooms. Let's see. Somebody had a question here about, yes, DM Murdoch III. Have you used the Disney Wow calibration Blu-ray disc? Yes, I have. And I like it very much. It works great. It's especially good for newbies and people of a, shall we say, less technical bent. The other discs that I use all the time are High Definition Benchmark from Spears and Munsell and Digital Video Essentials HD Basics from Joe Kane. Both of those discs are great, and they really work well to set up the basic picture controls of your TV, that is brightness, contrast, color, tint, and sharpness. But... they're a little less intuitive, shall we say. And Disney Wow was designed for the less experienced person who still wants to get their TV close to the best it can be. So I definitely recommend that one. No question about it. Let's see here. Wari says that Expand 3D is the most common in Finland. Okay, Expand is the leader, the market leader in active glasses. No question about it. But and the other thing I will mention about home 3D anyway is that active glasses give you full resolution HD in both eyes because you're seeing a 1920 by 1080 in one eye and then 1920 by 1080 in the other eye. The way the passive glasses work at home on a flat panel by Vizio and LG and Toshiba is you have 1080 lines, horizontal lines composing the picture. And in the case of those TVs, when you're watching 3D, the lines alternate. So the odd numbered lines go to your right eye, say, and the even numbered lines go to your left eye or vice versa. I don't remember. But the point is they're essentially interlaced. And so each eye is only seeing 540 lines. So you might think to yourself, well, that's not high definition, and it's not. But a weird thing happens. When you watch 3D under those conditions, the brain tends to fuse the two images together into a single stereoscopic image. And the detail that you see on the screen is actually greater than you would possibly be able to expect with 540 lines. Now, there is one little problem that sometimes crops up on these sets, and that is when you see light-colored lettering on a dark background, like titles or credits, things like that, you sometimes see very fine, thin black lines in those letters. And that is because you're only seeing half the information, alternating lines, in each eye. But most of the time in regular images, I don't notice it, at least when I'm sitting at the right distance from the screen. Now, if you sit too close, you will see them in everything. So you sit at the right distance from the screen, most of the time it won't be a problem, only in those few instances. And I'm willing to live with that for the advantage of more light coming to my eye and lighter and less expensive glasses. That's the other cool thing about passive glasses. They're a lot less expensive than active ones because they don't have any electronics. So that is another thing to keep in mind. Eric Duckman brings up a good point. Don't forget the HDMI cable question. We had this last week, and we were not talking about HDMI last week. So I kind of ducked those questions, Eric Duckman. I wanted to make sure to get to them this week. Pardon me. But before I do, and we will certainly get into that, but I do want to take a moment at this juncture to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Of course, everyone watching and listening to this show knows by now that Netflix offers thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed directly to your home via basically any electronic device you have in your home, including TVs directly into your TV, Blu-ray players, streaming boxes like Roku or Boxy, game consoles, PS3, Wii, and so on, smartphones, iPhones, iPads, Android phones, some Windows phones, just about any device these days. Any audio video type device will stream Netflix into your home. You can even start on one device and finish watching the same program on another. It's so convenient, very easy, and instantaneous. Talk about instant gratification. Now, Netflix is offering a 30-day free trial. If you're one of the few who hasn't tried it yet, I do encourage you to do so. Just go to netflix.com/twit and sign up for a free 30-day trial. Once you try it, I bet you'll be hooked. And don't forget to use that URL, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. Okay, now before I get to the HDMI cable question, my wife Joanna has shown up, and I would love to introduce her to the chat room. Some of you already know Joanna Kasdan. Otherwise known in the chat room as Mrs. Scott. Come on in. Hi.
Hi.
Let's see if we can get you into the shot here. There you are.
Here I am. Hi, everybody.
J- Joanna actually got her master's degree in theater arts at CalArts and helped me with the set design of my new studio and the lighting. And so I thank you very much for that.
It was fun. Yeah. It was fun. I like doing creative stuff, just like you do.
Yep. Yep. Well, that's why we're together, isn't
it? That's one of the many reasons. Yep. Yep.
Now, Joanna's also a musician, and I am planning to actually do some music from this room. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, you'll come and bring your guitar when we have the music studio set up.
Right. Or play keyboard.
Sing. Absolutely. And we'll actually do some music from here, and I'm sure looking forward to that. But I just wanted to make sure that everybody said hi to Mrs. Scott.
It will be harder for me to be online during your show because you've asked me to stay off the internet.
Well, yeah, but
when you do shows from Petaluma, I can chime in from here.
Oh, absolutely. And the chat room doesn't take much bandwidth. So if you want to chime into the chat room, I think that would be okay.
Well, okay.
Okay. Thanks for stopping by.
Right now, I'm going to go. Take care of some other stuff.
Okay.
Have a good time.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, Eric Duckman, IRC is very low bandwidth, so that shouldn't really be a problem. Okay. So thank you, everybody. Joanna's wonderful. URL Wallace says, great catch, and I couldn't agree more. We have been married now, we're coming up on 22 years, and we met and started playing music together, and our first gig was a couple weeks after we met, and somebody came up to us afterwards and said, so how many years have you guys been playing together? it was, in fact, meant to be. Anyway, HDMI. Let's get back to HDMI. HDMI 1.3... and HDMI 1.4. What's the difference? The cables are often labeled with one or the other of these numbers. Is there a difference? The answer is no. Probably not. HDMI 1.3 and HDMI 1.4 are both supposed to be able to carry a maximum amount of digital bandwidth of 10.2 gigabits per second. So if a cable is truly capable of carrying HDMI 1.3 or HDMI 1.4, they're able to carry the same amount of data. So there's no difference. The cable doesn't care what kind of data it is. HDMI 1.4 does add several features that HDMI 1.3 doesn't have. For example, 3D. And also what's called audio return channel. So, for example, if you have an HDMI cable plugged from your AV receiver output to your TV input, and you then use the TV's internal tuner to watch TV, say from a rooftop antenna, the TV can send the audio from its internal tuner back to the receiver over the same cable. Now, both the receiver and the TV have to have this feature enabled in order for this to work, but an HDMI 1.3 cable or an HDMI 1.4 cable, either one should work if they are able to carry the full HDMI 1.3 or 1.4 bandwidth of 10.2 gigabits per second. I have long maintained that it is not necessary to buy expensive HDMI cables, except perhaps if they're fairly long cable runs. Then you're going to want the best quality and the best connectors you can get. But I try to keep my HDMI cable runs as short as possible. And in so doing, it really doesn't matter. You don't need to buy really expensive cables. Monster does tend to rate their cables for bandwidth. And not all cables are rated at 10.2. Some of them are rated more like 6.something. And I would try to get cables that specify 10.2 gigabits. And if as long as you have that, it doesn't matter whether it's called 1.3 or 1.4. DG Murdoch III asks, does HDMI carry Dolby and THX audio over the cable? this brings up a common misconception, which I wrote about on hometheater.com, and I would direct you there for more information. Dolby and THX are not the same thing at all. THX is a post-processing function that is overlaid on top of Dolby or DTS audio. So Dolby and DTS are the same thing. They are competitors. They do the same thing. They encode audio into a digital bitstream. And you can have a lossy bitstream where a lot of information is thrown away in order to save bandwidth. That's Dolby Digital or regular old DTS. Or you can have lossless audio, which doesn't throw away any information. It just compacts it down as much as it can, takes more bandwidth, but that's known as Dolby True HD or DTS HD Master Audio. Those are the lossless forms of Dolby and DTS. And yes, HDMI carries both of those easily. No problem whatsoever. Any flavor of Dolby, any flavor of DTS, HDMI will carry it. It does not carry THX audio because THX doesn't encode audio. THX is only applied to the audio after it gets to where it's going, into the receiver or the preamp processor. Then THX post-processing is applied to the audio, but it is not carried by HDMI because it's not something like Dolby or DTS. Keep asks, will home theater continue on Twit? I certainly hope so. I'm planning on it. Let's see. ARC, Beatmaster says, ARC, audio return channel, what I was talking about a minute ago, is very messy depending on the age of the components. That's true. ARC is a relatively new thing, and so you need relatively new components that have it implemented in order for it to work. Wes asks, the TV receiver would also have to be 1.4 ready. That's correct. And that is something to be concerned about when you're shopping for a receiver and a 3D TV. If you have a 3D TV, it by default has to have HDMI 1.4 implemented. And if you're shopping for a receiver, you want one that has HDMI 1.4 so that if you have a 3D Blu-ray player or a 3D broadcast source, the 3D signal will pass through the AVR, the audio-video receiver, and on to the TV. If you have an older receiver that does not pass 3D through, there's a couple of ways you can get around that if you have a 3D TV and a 3D Blu-ray player. One is, hopefully, you have a 3D Blu-ray player with two HDMI outputs. The higher-end Panasonics have that. I think the higher-end Samsungs do as well. Maybe the Sonys also. You can take one HDMI output, send it to the receiver for the audio, take the other HDMI output, connect it directly to an HDMI input on the 3D TV, bypassing the receiver in terms of video, and that solves that problem. So let's see here. Lawn Dog asks, if you have full range speakers in your 5.1 surround system and you add a subwoofer, do you think the subwoofer is best to be used only during movies? Wow, this is a very interesting question. And audiophiles will tell you, yes, absolutely. Only use the subwoofer for movies. Because movies have... The sound system of movies is called, as we know, 5.1 or 7.1, and it's the 0.1 that the subwoofer is really best at. The 0.1 channel is called the LFE, or low frequency effects channel. And that's the channel that carries explosions and dinosaur roars and rocket blast off and that kind of thing. Very, very low frequency. I've heard that it can go down to 5 hertz or lower. It approaches DC, one guy told me. Now, no subwoofer, unless you want to spend a whole heck of a bunch of money, can go down to 5 hertz. You can get these things called sort of generically, but there's actually a model also called the Butt Kicker. Another company that makes these things is called D-Box, and it's actually a transducer that you install in your seat, and it actually moves the seat around in these super low frequencies. Personally, they make me sick. I'm prone to motion sickness, and so I wouldn't sit in one if you paid me. But some people like them. But anyway, that's where the super low frequencies could go. But generally speaking, the subwoofer is used to reproduce this low frequency effects, or LFE channel. Now, in terms of music, some people complain that if you pass the low frequencies, say below 80 hertz or so, to the subwoofer, you get a less homogenized, less integrated sound than if you have a full range speaker, two full range speakers in your front that are reproducing all of the frequencies. And so there is an argument to be made for that. And in that case, what I would do, you have to go into the receiver's menu system and you have to set, there's a place in the menu system that lets you set whether the speakers are large or small. If they're set to large, they get all of the frequencies in that channel, all, the entire full range. If they're set to small, then the frequencies below the crossover point, which you can specify, it's typically 80 hertz, get shunted off to the subwoofer, which is what I would do for movies, certainly. But for music, you might want to go in and change your speaker settings so that your fronts are set to large so that they reproduce the entire spectrum without shunting the low frequencies off to the subwoofer. Now, I will say that I tend to prefer shunting the low frequencies off to the subwoofer because the location of the low frequency driver in your room has a large effect on how the low frequencies sound. And the best place for that low frequency driver is not usually the same as the best place for the rest of the frequencies coming out of the speaker. So if the speaker is truly full range and it's reproducing all the very low frequencies, Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony starts with triple low C at 32 hertz. If that's coming from where the main speakers are, you might have a different bass experience and not as good a one as if it were coming from a well-placed subwoofer. So that's an argument that for even in music, shunting the low frequencies off to the subwoofer. Ultimately, it's a personal taste thing. You know, try it both ways. See which one you prefer. Let's see. Gray Bix asks, how has my Boxy experience been so far? Generally speaking, very, very good. I like it quite a bit. I found one weird thing, which is as I'm watching something streaming about, I don't know, 5 to 10 to 15 minutes in, there'll be a momentary hiccup and then the volume gets louder. I don't know what's going on with that. It happens no matter what I'm streaming. Mostly I'm streaming from Netflix, and that might be a Netflix problem or it might be a Boxy problem. I don't know yet. I haven't solved that particular problem. So, but other than that, and the fact that, you know, the quality of the video that comes from, again, I'm using mostly Netflix, is, shall we say, variable. Some things look fabulous and some things look really bad. And I suspect that's not to do with Netflix so much as it is to do with how the content was encoded in the first place. I'm actually watching some older content from my youth, reliving my youth, as it were. And some of that stuff is pretty old. And yet some of it still looks pretty good. And some of it's got all kinds of banding and solarization in it and really weird looking stuff. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. None of it looks as good as Blu-ray. I will say that for sure. If you want the absolute best picture quality possible and sound quality, Blu-ray is still the way to go. And a lot of people ask the question, well, you know, is physical media on its way out? Is streaming going to replace physical media? And I certainly hope not. I suspect that physical media will probably become more like a niche like vinyl is now. And look at vinyl. Vinyl records are actually increasing in popularity, which is why we've started a whole new website in my company called analogplanet.com, edited by Michael Fremmer, who was a guest on the show a couple of weeks ago. You know, there's enough interest to have a whole website devoted to that. So I suspect that physical media will stay around for a long time, and particularly if and when we get to 4K. Right now we have a resolution on the screen in high definition of what's called 1080p or 1920 by 1080. The next step up in resolution is going to be 4K or 4096 by 2160. And we already have at least one consumer projector that can display that, but we don't have any content. And I don't see any real way to distribute that content. Even if the studios were willing to, it would be very difficult. And I doubt anyone's going to stream 4K. YouTube has 4K, I will say that. And they are streaming it. But its whole, man, is it compressed. And I would love to see some way to get high quality 4K into the home, which I think will have to be some sort of physical medium, either an optical disc, something related to Blu-ray. It won't be Blu-ray itself. It'll be some next generation, or possibly solid state. You know, a thumb drive, sorta, kinda, SD card. Red Digital Cinema has made a 4K projector and a 4K source device, which is hard disk based, and you load it up with content from an SD card. So I could imagine buying a 4K movie on an SD card, loading it into this Red player, which is supposed to be like $1,000. You know, I mean, that's not that much. And their projector is like 10 grand for a home version. And granted, that's a lot of money. I won't deny that in any way, shape, or form. But compared to the Sony 4K projector, which is $25,000, it's coming down really fast. Let's see. Yeah, Beatmaster says, I agree. Blu-rays are the best quality. That's why I put them on a NAS, network-attached storage, and play it over media players. Well, as long as you don't have to compress it anymore than it already is. I mean, even Blu-ray is compressed, but it's compressed a lot less than any kind of streaming media. The bit rate in a Blu-ray player is like 40 megabits per second. And you're lucky if you're getting 6 megabits per second into your home, which is really what you need for high definition. Lawn Dog asks, as we all hook up our TVs to our stereo systems, which could have a lot of wattage, do you see people who broadcast our TV or cable programs the problem when the commercials come on and sometimes movies need volume added to them to make them sound right? And when the commercial comes in, bam, you're blasted. Yes, this is a big problem. Congress has even addressed this problem with the CALM Act. I forget what C-A-L-M stands for, but probably somebody in the chat room might be able to tell me. But it is supposed to address this. But, you know, how likely that is to actually help, I don't know. There are several companies that make AV receivers that try to solve the problem. Odyssey, which makes a very nice automatic setup system for automating the optimization of your sound system to your room, has a feature called Volume. Odyssey Volume, I think, and Dynamic Volume, that's what it's called. Dolby has one too. So if you're looking for an AV receiver, look for one that has Odyssey Dynamic Volume or Dolby Volume or THX Loudness Plus, which is again post-processing, but which the other ones are too. That will definitely help mitigate that problem. The other way to do it is to engage in your AV receiver what's called midnight mode, which is a dynamic range compressor. And it's meant for when, if you're watching TV in your home theater and someone's trying to sleep in the next room, you can listen at a lower volume and things don't go from really quiet to really loud, but rather the dynamic range is compressed. And that would also help with this change in volume from commercials between the program and the commercials. But it does also restrict the dynamic range, which you may or may not want. yes, laser projector. Let's see. We're just about out of time. Look at that. How the time has flown. Let me just get in one or two quickies here. EJZ, is there an automatic feature of LED LCD TVs to switch between HD and standard def without having the SD picture stretch? Yes, typically there is. This is in the aspect ratio control, and either aspect ratio, sometimes it's called picture size, and basically you just set it to auto or some such setting, and it will do what you're saying. Standard def will be in 4x3 with bars on the side, and high def will be 16x9. So you just have to go into the picture size or aspect ratio control and set that to automatic. I'm really sad to say, and the time has flown by, and we are now at the end of the first show in the new studio and at the new time. I thank you all very much for being here. My online home, as I've mentioned, is hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. As I mentioned before, next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Bob Heil, who provided some of the equipment I'm using today and will continue to use into the future. We'll be talking about microphones and headphones and speaker design and who knows what. Bob's a very interesting and creative guy with lots of interesting stories to tell. I might try to get some more out of him about his early days in rock and roll. Because that's very, very interesting stuff. He's like one of the only engineers in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So that should be very, very fascinating. In the meantime, I hope you all have a great 4th of July, which is coming up in just 2 days. I'm going to a Dodger game, and there will undoubtedly be great fireworks there. I hope you all find some wonderful fireworks and stay safe. And until then, geek out.